Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With Jenny Winter.
Hello, beautiful humans listening to this. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am super pumped because today I get to interview someone who I have admired from afar for a very long time. It is the one, the only Cal Wilson. Actually, I say that there is another one, which is funny because I found this. I had a mutual friend on Facebook called Cal Wilson that I added thinking it was Cal Wilson, and it turns out it wasn't. It was another Cal Wilson, who's a guy who accepted my friend request. Weird. Anyway, that's a little bit of trivia you really didn't need to know. Many of you will know Cal. She is freaking hilarious. She's a mama. She's been on Australian TV and New Zealand TV for a very long time. You might have seen her on Spicks and Specs, Good News Week, Thank God You're Here, QZ, We Have a Problem. I mean, basically, name any awesome comedy TV show from the last decade and a half, and she's probably been on it. And she is just a beautiful human being to boot. So luckily for me, we were performing together on a cruise ship a little while back. And so I jumped at the opportunity to, eat my body weight in the buffet and interview Cal in the comfort of her cabin. So the sound is a little bit different, the sound quality, plus probably my excitement levels. A bit different too. But yes, please enjoy this lovely, lovely conversation with the wonderful Cal Wilson.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Beautiful Cal. So obviously, like, I know your comedy, like, more than I know you as a person. Can you just tell me a little bit about how, once you became a mother, how that changed your life?
It was like being made CEO of a company I'd never worked for. That's the way I describe it, because I was like, oh, why am I in charge? Like, it was I mean, I've only got one. Mm-hmm. But it really, I think it took me a year and a half to feel like I got my brain back. Like, because I'm a sort of person that's always got like three lanes of traffic in my head. I don't even know if that makes up a proper road, but like, I've always got more than
it's
one.
It's a highway.
Yeah. Two lanes on one side and then the other one's just one way. I don't know what's going on there. That's why I don't do engineering. Because I'm always just like always thinking at a million miles an hour. And when I had the baby, it just all went. Like, I think because I was so exhausted and he wasn't a great sleeper and I'm a terrible sleeper anyway. And so it really slowed me down and it frightened me because I was like, but my whole job is about being able to be quick. And,
oh, wow.
And bang, 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 you know, kind of thing. And also the universe shrank down to just our house with a baby in it. And so it's sort of like, you know, I was doing, I think, Good News Week at the time and going, I don't know what's going on in the world. Like, I really panicked about whether I was going to be still the same person after. And obviously you're not the same person, but, it just really, it really shook me up, I think, in a way that I hadn't been expecting. I think when you're, like, I had him quite late, I was 38 when I had him, so by that stage in your life, you're pretty good at most of the stuff that you do, and so it was that weirdness of, oh, I'm not good at this because I haven't been doing this for years, I'm starting out totally fresh and I don't know how that works or this works, or am I, just sort of like, I found it quite overwhelming for a start, but at the same time it was the most magnificent thing to happen, you know, like, the other thing I always say is it's the one time in your life where it's great that your partner's in love with someone else, like, because you both,
oh, that's a beautiful way to
you're
put it.
Both in love with this little baby, and he's incredible, and it's still, so I was simultaneously panicking about getting myself back, but at the same time I was also going, oh, it doesn't really matter, like a terrible gig is still the worst, but it's not my real life, like, you know, like, my real life is, well, you just walked in as I was FaceTiming my son, and, like, that's Like, I just
that's
love
it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I just love him so much. And I love my work, and I don't want to retire. My husband said I want to retire early, and I burst into tears. I don't want to retire. I really do love my work, but it's given me a sense of perspective of going, if I can make my son laugh, it means more to me than making an audience laugh. That's not to say I don't love your audiences, but just, do you know what I mean?
Like, absolutely.
Well, I mean, you've got a number of kids, so.
Well, also, my kids are a bloody tough crowd, so if I can make them laugh.
Oh, aren't they? Oh, my gosh.
It's for real.
Yeah.
They're not going to fake freaking laugh. No, they'll go, you're on TV.
Yeah. Yeah, he's so unimpressed by all that stuff. Like, he's just like, because that's what people's parents do. They go on TV or the radio.
Of course.
Or whatever, so it's no big deal. Like, which is really great. And I tell jokes about, you know, how we were in a shop together and a woman complimented me and said she really enjoyed me as a comedian, and then after she left he went, did you know her? Because why else would she give you a compliment, sort of thing? And I went, oh no, she just said that she enjoys me as a comedian. He goes, oh, but she doesn't like you as a shopper. So it's just like he just takes the wind out of his sails all the time, which is really lovely and great because it keeps you really grounded about stuff.
Yeah, they're not going to let you go off with the fairies and be too big for your boots.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Oh, my God. Can I ask, before you had him, when you were pregnant, were you worried then about how it would change your comedy?
Not really. Mm. I just kind of, I mean, it was such an interesting experience. Like, the whole, like, your body's taken over by this whole other body. I kept having that mental image of the tiny man, the tiny alien inside the man's head in Men in Black, you know, where there's like the diplomat from another planet or something. And I felt like, oh, there's a little alien inside my head that's doing manual override on stuff. So it's kind of like, oh, must eat, must sleep. Like, just like, like your body just kind of takes over and goes, oh, no, you need to do this now.
Yeah.
Oh, you might need to vomit just now. You have to have another foot long. Like, it was just kind of, it's so interesting. And also the weirdness I hadn't expected of my ass got really big, and I was like, he's not in my ass. It's not like he's living in the caravan out the back. Like, why has that got large? And just, you know, the sweeping things off the table with your ass because you didn't realise it went out that far. Stuff and
a
just
whole
like,
new world.
Yeah, and I had another friend that was pregnant at the same time. We used to text each other what we found in our bras that night. Like, because I had cleavage that I've never had before. And so I'd just take my bra off and there'd be like pine nuts or a little bit of feta or something.
Just feta.
Showered onto the bed. So I enjoyed the process, but it was full on, but I loved writing material about that as well. And then after he was born, I did one gig that was like a breast cancer fundraiser, and it was like the only time I could do a whole bunch of material about just the kind of physical
process
of having had a baby. And I got nipple thrush, which are two words you never want to put in a sentence
together.
Oh, God,
my sister got that.
It was awful. Oh. So I had it for 6 months, but I persevered with breastfeeding.
Far out.
And so we tried everything. And nothing was working, so they sent me to the Royal Women's Hospital to get gentian violet, which is apparently some really old remedy, and you can only get it from that pharmacy now because it's, I don't know, it's probably some incredibly poisonous thing. But it's like deep purple drops, and so I had to put it on my nipples to kind of try and cure the thrush, but it gave Digby a purple moustache. And so...
Like, what are you doing to that child?
I was like, why are you dressing him as a tiny man? Because everyone always wants to look at your baby, and then they look at this baby, it's got a purple ring around its mouth. It was just, so things like that. So, like, I kind of did a few gigs. I could do a couple of gigs where I could talk about that stuff. But then it was kind of, I felt like I had to get back into, don't just talk about your baby kind of
thing.
And don't talk about the kind of real... the earthy nature of the physical process, because when you have a baby, the first few months are just all about adhesive pads, you know, your nipple shields and your sanitary pads and all that kind of, like, everything just seemed to have stuff that stuck to other things, like nappies and just, like...
I never thought of it like that. That's very true.
It was just all about things that stick to other things.
So true. Oh, my God. Did you... so, obviously, you got a lot of inspiration out of... everything you've gone through along the way. When how old was he when you started going back to gigging?
I went back to work on the radio when he was 8 weeks old.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was, looking back, just ridiculous. Like, because I was doing morning radio, but I'd have to get up at 5 to express milk and then go in and do the radio from 9 till 12.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on radio with Dylan Lewis, who was so lovely and also had a small child. So, you know, I was expressing milk while the songs were playing and then turning the pump off.
It's not a great during sound. The
during the talk break. So, like from that point of view, he was the perfect person to be doing that with, because he was such a... it was just no bother to him. He totally got it. We had a 19-year-old male receptionist who did not get it and would bring visitors to the station into the studio while I was expressing milk and never seemed to remember that. Please, maybe don't do that.
I wonder if in, like, 20 or 30 years when he's got kids, he'll look back at that and go, oh, shit. Yeah. Like, oh.
Yeah, and it, breast milk became the most precious thing. Like, so... I'm not answering your question.
No, I'm loving it.
So I would express milk in the studio and then take it home. Because I went back so early, it felt like one thing I could do for Digby was give him milk. My guilt was such that the one mothery thing I felt that I could do for him, which is ridiculous, I was doing lots of mothery things, but I really was quite hard on myself. So I would take the breast milk home and we'd put it in the fridge or whatever, or the freezer, and... I was driving home from work one day and Chris rang me and sounded really upset, and he goes, something terrible has happened. And I was like,
oh my God, no.
Like, pull off. I'm like, what happened? He goes, I'm so sorry, but I knocked a bottle of your breast milk over and it's all spilt. And like, we were both literally crying over spilt milk. Like, we were like, I was like, oh, it's fine. But like, he knew it would take me like an hour to get that amount out. But I was like, just don't ever start a sentence with something terrible has happened. Like, because, you know, of course I was like, oh, Digby's no longer with us or whatever.
God.
Yeah. But yeah, so I started doing a few like Good News Weeks, I think, when maybe he was about 3 months old. But mm-hmm. I reckon it was a few months on, but I did a show at the Fringe Festival, I think when he was about 9 months old or something, maybe, just to see if I was still funny. Like, and it was like a perfectly fine show, but nothing fantastic, but I just needed to kind of go, it's still here, kind of.
Yeah, you still got it. Did you feel like, that guilt thing is quite full on.
It's a killer.
And we're so hard. Did you feel any, like, criticism from other people about going back early?
Not really. I think because my friendship circle understood, like, it's kind of like, I knew that my contract was ending at the end of the year, and I was like, this is the last time I'm getting radio money, so I need to get as much radio money as I can to save. And Chris worked from home, but so he was like the primary carer right from
the,
really great. But I was really conscious, like, when we went to the doctor for things, the doctor would ask me a question and I'd be like, I can't answer that because Chris is the one that's at home. And I would feel, that would make me feel inadequate, which is not what the doctor was doing, but was how I was feeling it, was, that's my thing. The thing that we noticed was that people found it weirder that Chris was staying at home. We had a couple of people that we knew that were just like, just couldn't get their heads around that he was at home and was happy for me to be earning most of the money. Like, it was just really... which I also found surprising. And just things like, you know, Chris was taking him to Mother's Group, and it was a council-run Mother's Group, and he said, do you think you could change the name of it to Parents Group? So it's more inclusive. And the woman was like, oh, no, I think that would make the mums uncomfortable.
And so
it just stayed Mum's Group, but with a dad in it. Like, it was sort of little things like that. I think, this is 10 years ago, so I'm imagining
Well, they're parents' rooms now and stuff, aren't they?
Yeah, sort of thing. Yeah, I don't feel I got judgment. I remember talking to another friend who also went back to work quite soon after her kids were born, and she found at school pickup she felt judgment from other mothers. If she was there on the rare occasions that she could pick the kids up from school, they were like, oh, I haven't seen you for a while, kind of.
How nice you could be here.
That kind of thing. And Chris was really amazing. So he would bring Digby into the radio station. Even though I was only there for 3 hours, sometimes he'd just bring him in the morning so I could have a wee cuddle.
Oh, that's like so
halfway
nice.
Through the break. And it was such a team effort. Like, I wouldn't have been able to continue without him just being solidly on my team.
That is so brilliant.
I'm so fortunate.
Super supportive. Hubby on board.
And there's no ego in him about she earns more money than I do or anything like that, which I think is so valuable.
Again, that's amazing. Like, that's just it's weight in gold, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. I'm so, that's so happy for you. That's bloody awesome.
I feel so grateful. Like, he's so, you know, and I feel very fortunate. Like, I sometimes get to do gigs, like the Comedy Festival Roadshow. Went to Hong Kong and Singapore last year, and so I could take the boys with me. So it was just really lovely.
So good.
Rather than always going, oh, it would be really great if you were here, we did a cool thing today. It was just really lovely to have them
and share that world. Absolutely. That's awesome. Can I also ask, so being on TV so soon after having a baby, did you feel any pressure body-wise to like...
The weirdest thing, before I learnt the lesson that you never Google yourself...
Oh, shit. Like, do you mean like people commenting?
There was a... I found a creepy page where two dudes were commenting on how they hoped that I kept breastfeeding because my tits were enormous.
Oh no.
And I was like, I don't Google myself anymore. That was like the last time, because I was just like, oh, that's fucking
that's
creepy.
Just disgusting.
How gross. I like, breastfeeding kind of ate the weight off me, but the thing that no one had prepared me for, like, I knew my boobs would get bigger, but I didn't know they wouldn't be the same size.
Oh my God, so, I don't think mine still are, to be honest.
So I was calling one the Uber boob, because it was like so, it was so much bigger. And so my memory of doing TV at that stage, I was hosting a show when he was 5 months old, and me and the wardrobe woman would just stand in the dressing room, and she'd just stick more and more like padding down one side, then we'd step back and look at it in the mirror and go, do they look even now? She's like, no, I think we need another one. Like, so,
oh, that's so good.
So that sort of stuff was that whole thing of like, TV looks so finished and polished and seamless and invisible, and then behind the things it's just like Spanx and leaky and, you know, like
all
that kind. Loads of padding in one boob and all that sort of stuff.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Do you, like, have you found too, like, you know how, like, motherhood's one of those things that until you've actually done it, you can't really fully get it, like, what it is. Have you found, like, stronger connections with other mums in your industry and stuff like that, or in general?
I remember we had a friend years ago. I was working on a show with her, and she came back to work after 3 weeks after her child was born. And at the time, we were just like, oh, she's so organised. And, you know, her husband was bringing the baby to the set and things. And then when I had my son, I was like, oh, my God, you're fucking incredible. Like,
wow, yeah.
3 weeks. Like, I don't think I've been outside the house in 3 weeks. Like, I think I was still at that stage that the baby would cry and I'd be like, oh, the cat sounds different. Like, but she was sort of back in the world, just, you know, getting on with the job, because that was the choice she felt that she needed to make. And so, like, looking back, I'm just like, oh my God, what a superwoman.
That's
like,
amazing.
Yeah.
I actually remember being really judgy of my cousin's car, because this is before I had kids, and being in my cousin's car, I had three tiny kids, and just being like, oh my God, there was like biscuit shit everywhere, and just shit everywhere. Like, it was like covered in crumbs and stuff, and being like, oh my God. And then when I had kids, I was like, oh my God, like, totally, I cannot believe, like, what car isn't? Like, come on. Yeah.
My thing like that was like, oh, you know, parents that don't really take care of themselves, like... And then I remember after Digby was born, I think he was maybe 2 months old, and he'd weed a little bit on my T-shirt, and my thought process was, it's just a little bit of wee. And then I went to the shops.
Totally.
As if I would go anywhere covered in urine before I had a child.
Oh my God, I think I actually have a memory of being in an early gig and having pumpkins, realising as I was in the car that there was pumpkin soup on the back, like spit on the back of my shirt, and just going, whatever, and like going along and doing
pumpkin.
It. Like, it's on the back. Yeah. They're not going to see it.
And the other thing was, you know, when you'd see people feed their kids and then like the kid would drop something out of its mouth and the parent would eat the thing and be going, oh my God, it's disgusting. But then you're like, oh, I made you. You're still basically my body. I will have that half a cracker.
Yes,
like,
exactly. How quickly your standards
just drop.
Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah. I know, it's very easy, isn't it, to be perfect at everything when you've got no freaking clue really what's happening.
And then the reverse of that is, I remember our lovely friend Greg, who does not have children, came over when Digby was maybe, I don't know, he was a toddler, and Digby fed him some broccoli and Greg ate it. And I was like, you know, you just pretend to eat it, don't you? Because I don't even, I wouldn't.
Oh, Oh, that's adorable.
He, let Digby put this half mumbled piece of broccoli in his mouth and ate the broccoli. And I was like, oh, you could have just gone, and that would have been.
Oh, that's a very lovely committed friend.
Yeah.
I'm going there.
The look of horror in his eyes was very evident, but
that's amazing.
Yeah, like looking back, and like I remember my mum and dad came when Digby was 2 weeks old. They came over from New Zealand, and mum walked in the door, and I just burst into tears and went, "I'm so sorry. I had no idea how you felt about me." And it was such a realization of, oh, all of the things that you've ever done that pissed me off at the time because you've been too overprotective. It was just because you really fucking loved me. Like it was real. It was a real revelation of like, oh right, like I still don't agree with some of those things, but just because I was the most precious thing.
Yes.
Yeah, it was like, so that was the I hadn't expected that to happen. It just sort of came out, but that's, I was like, beautiful. You are the, like, if we went to Healesville Sanctuary, we took mum and dad to Healesville Sanctuary, and there's a part where you can walk through, like, the emus and the kangaroos. And this emu started walking towards us, and Digby was in the pram, and I had this very clear thought of, if you come any closer, I will fuck you up. Like, that, just that kind of...
Yeah, primal
thing, like, I'm going to snap your neck. Like, as if I would win against an emu. But just in that moment, it was like that kind of primordial rage of, like, get away from him! Like...
Can you imagine the publicity of how New Zealand Kelly attacks Aussie emu? Oh my God, what an image. And it's something about the emu is so specifically funny about that.
Yeah, it's like, you're 7 foot tall, it's enormously powerful, has hugely sharp talons.
Oh my God.
I was like, yeah, you're not having that child.
Uh-huh. Do you get to see parents much? Like, do they come to school?
We FaceTime all the time.
Awesome.
They're too... old to come over, and they're not too old to come over, but they travelling would be too much for them, so because they're in their 80s now, so we FaceTime all the time, and we go over at least once a year to Christchurch, so we have turnabout with Christmas.
Great.
We have Christmas Day in New Zealand and Christmas Day in Australia the next year, sort of thing. So I see them as much as I can. Sometimes I get to do gigs and things over there, but FaceTime has just changed.
Oh, isn't it amazing?
Oh, it's so good. So Digby has a relationship with his New Zealand family, his cousins and everybody, because he knows them.
Yeah.
And he's always known them. And it's not just having to get used to each other at Christmas.
That's amazing. Yeah, that is a game changer. And also, I guess, in terms of being a touring comedian, such a game changer.
Yeah, we were on FaceTime when he came in. Like,
fantastic. Yeah, you can feel that daily connection. Rather than it being separate. If you don't feel like talking about this, that's absolutely fine. As your parents are aging, like, are you feeling that pressure?
I am, but my brothers live very close to them, so...
Great, yeah.
So I think if I was an only child, I don't know that I could live away from them, so far away from them. But my two older brothers and their wives are brilliant, and...
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really comforting, because they quite literally live around the corner from each other, so it's really... Oh.
Brilliant.
Yeah, great. And I have wonderful nieces and nephews who also look after their grandparents as well. So that's...
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
I feel like, well, because I was raised by my grandmother, because my mother died when I was quite little.
Oh, wow.
And so we went through, she died a few years ago, but she was 90, so she had an amazing run. But, yeah, just that last few years, I did find that quite full on, because you're parenting tiny people, but you're also parenting your parent. Yeah. Like, it's this weird kind of... thing where it all comes full circle. And, but again, it's that crazy thing, I think, where... Like you were saying before, once you've got kids, you suddenly understand what it is to be a parent. And for me, at the end, like, taking care of her, it was felt like this is my turn to give back to you a little bit, it's just bloody circle of life and all that stuff.
So how was that for you when you became a mum, not having your mum? Like, did that bring up stuff?
Oh, 100%. I actually remember Ella being like 3 days old, and you know how they say at 3 days the milk comes in, the thing, and the milk did come in, but I just remember sitting there with her and just absolutely bawling my eyes out and just realizing it was like complete joy and happiness at having her. But it was like all of a sudden I saw it from my mum's perspective of going, oh my God, I cannot believe how much I love this little person, and going, God, my mum loved me. Like, I just was like, fuck, this is how much she loved me is how I feel right now. So it was this other, like, you know, I think the thing is with grieving as a child, it's the grief, just you go through so many stages of it, because as you get older
you're
experiencing
more, imagine,
a different and it's like this landmark and this it's just a constant thing. So that was just mind-blowing, but so beautiful as well to go, gosh, she loved us that much, there's no doubt in that. It's incredible. But it's funny too, with the perspective of sometimes when my kids are like, if they're being shitty or whatever, and I'm like, I'd give anything for my mum. I would never talk to my mum like that. But you can't really throw that down. It's not really fair. My mum died.
Is that what you want me to do? What do
I have to do? So anyway. But you've got a bloody laugh, don't you?
Yeah, you do, yeah. There's a really beautiful podcast called Griefcast, if I can plug someone else's podcast.
Oh, please,
it's really gorgeous. So it's an English comedian called Carrie Ann Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
She lost her dad to pancreatic cancer when she was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And so she just talks to a different comedian each week about someone they've lost.
Oh,
and it is
wow.
So beautiful, because it's people talking about something that we don't normally talk about enough.
Mm.
And because it's mainly comedians that she talks to, sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's sad. Well, obviously, but it's just so... It's such a generous thing to do, to allow people to listen to your story, and it just, I've got so much out of it, just thinking,
wow.
You know, yes, yeah, just gorgeous.
Have you been on it?
No, I haven't. Yeah. I haven't. And it's one of those weird ones where it's like, if you want to go on a podcast, someone has to die.
Sure, there is that, yes.
Yeah. But she's amazing. She's so lovely to listen to, but yeah, I've just got so much out of listening to everyone's different perspectives on grief, and you know, people that have lost like 6 family members in a year, or someone that that lost a child, like all that kind of stuff. So there's ones that the one that really got me was a widower whose wife had died suddenly, and having to tell his 9 and 11 year olds, you know, that sort of thing. It's so beautiful. It's really gorgeous.
That sounds... I love that stuff too, because, again, I guess because, like, I've always been very comfortable around, like, if someone loses someone, like, it doesn't make me feel uncomfortable to go and be, in that space, whereas I know a lot of people... Well, the tragic thing is, when tragedy strikes some people, a lot of the time it's not just the tragedy, but they lose a lot of friends because people just get too freaked out and sort of disappear. So it's like a double whammy. What was I going to say? Oh, there's another amazing podcast called Terrible. Thanks for asking.
Oh, yes.
Have you heard? Have you listened to that?
Yes,
oh my
great.
God, I love her. Yeah, but I love that too. And I think you know, we should be able to be more real with each other and open and
Like I went through a really awful relationship breakup, and everyone around me tried to like cheer me up and say, "Oh, it's not so bad" or whatever. And I had one friend that would go, "This is shit. You're fucked." Like, and she was the only, I felt like she was the only person that saw me. Like. She was the only person going, yeah, this is in a terrible position. You're awful. This is an awful situation, and it's not going to get better soon. And it just felt like she stopped me from feeling like people weren't deliberately gaslighting me, but that's how it felt. Of like,
right.
No, you have to see how awful the situation is, and to have one person who could just sit there and go, yeah, it's shit, and just be there with me in it was so amazing. And so I feel like I've learnt from that when someone else goes through something awful, I try and just be like, it's shit.
Yeah, to be real.
Yeah.
Do you think that's people saying that to try and make it better, like to fix it, or what do you think it is?
I think because no one wants someone you care about to hurt, but also you don't, it's uncomfortable seeing someone in pain.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not used to it, or you don't, you're not, we present ourselves to people, and so we show our best selves to people. And so when you're seeing someone who's in a really raw state, you don't know what to do with it necessarily. Like, and it, you don't want to say the wrong thing, so it's better if you just don't say anything. Like, that's, I think. But, yeah, so I kind of feel like if you can just stand beside someone and just acknowledge the reality of it, then that's really helpful. Well, that's
what
I found helpful.
I think so too. Just excuse me one sec. something
outrageous.
In there. Probably all my grief.
That's
incredible. I think I think it's really powerful too, if you can hold space for someone and just go, you don't have to change anything.
Yeah.
You don't have to pretend to be okay. You can just just be, but you're not alone.
And also, someone said something about a really great thing about don't stop inviting us places. Like, don't.
Oh wow.
Like, we won't come because we won't be able to, but. Just lets us know that you still think about us. Like, and I thought that was such a great thing to go, oh yeah, don't just assume, oh no, they're not going to want to come to a gig or whatever. It's like, but maybe they might. Maybe they may just want like 2 hours out of thinking about this thing that's happened.
And even if they don't for a year, it's still going, the door is open, the door is open, the door is open.
Yeah. This is kind of different but the same. One of the loveliest things a friend did after Digby was born was she made us a meal and she brought it round and said, I don't want the container back. This is your container.
Oh.
And it made such a big impression on me because it was like, oh, I don't have to worry about getting the dish back to Monique. Like, it was such a great thing.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it was such a great... That's been my biggest thing too, is like, so if I make someone a meal for whatever reason, just go, I don't want it back. Like, I don't want the containers back.
That is freaking great. Yeah.
Because it's a little thing that you're always like, oh shit, now I've got to, that's so lovely, but now I've got to wash that and I've got to keep it. And I don't know, was that Susan's or was it Lucy's or...
Totally.
Just that added thought.
And then I don't know, I feel like growing shame the longer it goes. Yes.
Oh man, I had this black and white striped bowl that had come to a barbecue at my house in Auckland. So,
oh wow.
Like more than 16 years ago, and I never gave it back to the person, and like it came to Australia with me because it was a great bowl, but like I would look at that bowl every day and be like, oh, that's awful, that's Pete's bowl, like just so. And then finally it broke and I was like, oh, there's nothing I can do. And because he was like a friend of a previous boyfriend, it was like, well, I have no
it's
way
never
of getting
happening
back to
that's amazing. Oh my god, that is a brilliant hack though. Can I ask, when you went through your horrendous breakup and things were super shit, were you doing comedy at that point already?
Yeah.
Did you find that a positive force for comedy, like to fuel it into? Or?
The thing that happened was I was on the New Zealand version of the panel, and I remember looking down the barrel, delivering a joke, and in my head I was going, I'm a liar.
Wow.
I'm a liar, because I appeared to be really happy and fine, but I was going through this terrible thing. There was a wee while where there was the material about it, but not much. But it's that thing. I don't know whether this happens for you, but on stage it's like you're safe for an hour. Like the outside world goes away. Even if you're talking about your life, you're still in this beautiful suspended time where all that matters is we're having a great time and we're laughing in the room. Like, so it was like a real place of safety. And so once I'd gone, because the I'm a liar thing happened before I broke up with them, and that was like the thing that made me go, oh, I need to break up with this guy because this is terrible.
Wow.
Yeah. And so to get back on stage afterwards was great, like to just be in that safe place again. And then I left New Zealand and came to Australia, and that was also nice to sort of leave all of that behind.
Right, yeah. And start
as well
over.
And start again, yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Have you found, do you sort of, like, process things through comedy? Like,
I think
things
so,
are,
yeah. I think it's also taken me a long time to realise, that sounds so stupid, that I should say what I think. Like, because I think I spent a long time not wanting to offend anyone, whereas now I'm like, I just want to tell you how I feel about something, and I don't ever want anyone to walk out feeling worse than they did when they walk in, but I also feel like I shouldn't be silent about some stuff. So, you know, like when the whole Me Too thing happened, I sort of talked about that and sexual harassment and things, and I just felt like we need to talk about it, like, and make it funny. Like, it's always got to be funny. We've got to find the way to make it not a lecture. But I was kind of like, why do I have this lovely platform where I can say what I think and I'm not saying what I think? So it felt like that felt like quite a recent thing, even over the last sort of 2 or 3 years of going, oh no, what am I doing? I should be not trying to please everybody. I should just be talking about stuff that matters.
That actually is really inspiring to me at the moment, because that's where I feel like I'm at.
Yeah,
feel like I get away, because I think I'm strong at selling it, whatever I'm doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess the improv thing, you know, that's what it's all about, is selling, you know, selling it and committing to it. But I feel like sometimes I'm like, what am I even talking about? Like, yeah. I can be amusing, like, and I can make people laugh, but I don't feel like I'm actually saying what I want to say. Like,
yeah. So I feel like when I do a festival show now, I think about this, like, there's one thing I want to say, and it's not 60 minutes about that one thing. It's 60 minutes of stuff that is funny, and then there is one thing that will hopefully make you think about it. Like, because I feel like it's got to be funny and it's got to be enjoyable, but it's... So I don't want it to be like, funny, 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 funny. Here's an important message, funny, 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 funny. Like, So I kind of go, this is the one important part for me, and it's always the hardest part to write. It's always the part I'm scared of writing. And then I work out how to make it funny. And the way I've worked out how to do that is that we do trial shows before the festival. And so I always used to write everything down and kind of finish the joke written down, and then I would learn it and then I would say it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now I go, this is the idea, and then I go on stage and I talk to the audience about it. So I kind of like workshop it on stage with the people at the trial show to kind of get an idea of, like, I don't know whether this happens to you, where in the act of asking someone a question of how to say something, you find the answer yourself.
Mm.
So in the act of me going, I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to say to you so that you can understand it, I figure out how I want to say it without you having to say anything.
Wow.
So it's a thing called the wooden monkey. I think it's known as the wooden monkey. So you ask the wooden monkey a question, it doesn't answer you, but you've worked out the answer because you've had to frame it for...
Wow. Okay, so when you say you're talking to the audience in those trial shows, you don't mean like a conversation.
Oh, sometimes a bit of a conversation.
Sometimes it is a bit to just get to the...
kind of, or, you know, does that make sense? Or... what do you reckon? Is it worth talking, like, sort of, so it's more of a chat and it's more, it kind of evolves more than it used to when I would try and sit down and write every word. So there are some jokes that I do which are definitely, like, language specific, like there's a definite wording that has to happen for the joke to work, and then there are other things where I just tell the story now in a way that I would have, like, polished it and honed it before it ever went on stage. Now I go, oh no, I find the way how to tell you.
Yes.
I'm telling you.
Yes. Oh, that's really cool. And the audience, I guess they know coming into it, that's
they know
what's going to happen.
Show and they
that's really cool because they can feel that. I mean, I imagine that's
quite
nice.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Mm.
Oh, cool. Kel, thank you so freaking much for doing this. Oh, look at that. Perfect timing. I'm going to do our little rapid fire segment if you're happy to. Okay. Kel Wilson, your life motto.
If you can make something better for someone, why wouldn't you?
Oh, love that. A moment that you're not proud of.
Any time I have raised my voice to my child.
Oh, I know. It sucks. And it does happen. And that's the thing. The thing that worries me is with, you know, trying not to be a judgy person, but when someone's going off in public over their kid,
awful.
I'm like, public's the best part. Like, public's the best parenting
your
best
you're going
to see. So you're like, ugh. But, ugh, God. The best advice that you've ever received?
The best advice I've ever received. You might have to cut this long pause out. What is it?
No, you know what? I need long pause for sound anyway. No pressure. No pressure.
Best advice. I don't know. It's more, you know, like the best things that people have done for me, I reckon, are the things of, like, standing with me when it's shit, like that kind of thing, or generosity to other people. What is it? Chris, actually, my husband has given me a great piece of advice that I've been following, and it's chase the no. So where if I'm going, I don't know whether they want me for this project, he's like, well, ask them, and then you get your no, and then you can move on.
I love that.
Yeah, and it's confronting. Oh, and this is the other one, actually, now that I'm thinking about it all. This is something I read, which I really love. Choose discomfort over resentment.
Oh.
So I am terrible at saying no to things. And people go, oh, will you do this free gig for me? Will you do this? And I am terrible at going, oh, you've asked me, so I have to do it. Okay, and then resenting the process all the way through.
Yeah.
And it's really uncomfortable to say no to someone. But choosing discomfort over resentment is so much better. It's so much to go,
yeah,
no, I'm not going to do your fundraiser. I'm so sorry. I've done 6 fundraisers. I can't do your fundraiser as well. Or, I don't want to do your horrible gig for a sandwich and a beer.
But thank you.
Yeah. Loving of you to think of me. Yeah. So just saying, but yeah, so choose discomfort over resentment and chase the no, the things that...
I love that. Yeah. Chase the no. That's a really good one for artists, isn't it?
It's a great one for artists, yeah.
I was going to say, so good old Oprah had something, because obviously she gets asked for it, friggin' everything on the planet. And even she said, I remember her telling a story about Stevie Wonder asked her to do some sort of appearance at something that he'd organised. And of course she's like, oh my God, well, it's Stevie Wonder. But she realised the only reason that she'd be saying yes to that is because she doesn't want Stevie Wonder to not like her. That's actually not a good enough reason to do it. And then she was like, and then she told him and he was like, cool, no worries. Like,
it's fine. Yeah. I was asking all the other famous people I know as well. You just wasn't all relying on you.
But I always think of that, what's your reason for doing it? Yeah. Like, if that's your reason, is it a good enough reason?
Yeah.
You know, because you're saying yes to something, you're saying no to being with your family or whatever else you want.
And also, sometimes you know that it's going to be a disaster. You know, like, the way you're organising this, it's going to be terrible. And I will have a miserable time, but I'm only considering it because I don't want you to be cross with me.
Yeah.
Like, and that similar kind of thing, and actually just going, no. I have a really great WhatsApp group of three friends who, like, it's everywhere. It's the other three people's job to tell you to shut the fuck up and say no, kind of.
Oh, that's great.
You go, oh, my God, remind me not to do this gig ever again. And then they're like, okay, I've been asked to do that gig again. Don't you do that gig again. kind of a cheer squad of like, no, boundaries, come on.
That's awesome. Yeah, you need that.
Yeah.
I think too, it's funny, isn't it, like doing improv and stuff and when you're starting out in this career and you have to say yes to so many things, it's very easy to go, I don't know how to say no anymore. Like, what? Yeah. Very, very good. Yeah.
I have to say, I'm not letting you through your questions.
Oh, please, no.
The whole improv rules of like say yes to everything has also been really good for me in terms of saying yes to opportunities or things where I go, that feels a little bit out of my comfort zone. Not shit gigs or anything, but, you know, things that seem a bit nerve-wracking and going, okay, yep, I'll do that, I'll say yes to that, because then, you know, in improv, if you say yes to an idea, everything progresses, but if you say no, you shut it down.
So, yes.
Yeah, just saying yes to stuff has really stood me in good stead as well.
It is very powerful. It's a powerful way to live life.
Yeah.
To be
in the moment.
That.
Yeah.
Have you read Amy Poehler's?
Yes.
Oh, God, I love that book so much.
Yes, so great.
Love her.
Yes, she's so great.
Okay. What's the worst advice you've ever received?
What's the worst advice I've ever received? Just go up and tell them how you feel, maybe. Maybe. Yeah, tell me that in terms of like a guy that I liked.
Oh my goodness, yeah. And had it pan out.
Well, okay, so it was at an improv festival and he was from Portland or somewhere. And I thought he was gorgeous, had long hair at a time when I found that attractive. And I went up to him and for some reason decided to go, I find you hideously attractive. Like, I don't know.
Hideously!
Why would I say hideously?
That's amazing.
I think I meant it in like an extreme, like extremely, but for some reason... Like, I find you alarmingly hot, or I don't know. But so I went up to him and said, I find you hideously attractive, and he went, you have good taste, and then walked away.
Oh, my God. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, sounds like you dodged a bullet, really. So. Oh, my God, hideously attractive. That's amazing. I'm just thinking about how I would feel if someone said that to me. Amazing.
Someone said it to me on Twitter that they found me weirdly attractive, and I was like, yeah, the weird part's not a compliment.
No.
Like, it's like, oh, I feel disgusted with myself, but I'm attracted to you. Like,
this is so weird because I wouldn't normally. Yeah,
I mean, you are objectively disgusting, but there's something, I don't know,
subjectively into it. Complete this sentence. Being a mother is
hundreds and thousands. Like, it's like muesli. It's like so many different things. It's the best and the hardest and the worst and the most fun.
It's perfect. And finally, written on your tombstone will be
written on my tombstone will be, at last she stopped talking.
Thank you so much, Cal.
A pleasure. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Funny Mummies podcast. If you haven't already, make sure you join our group on Facebook, the Funny Mummies group. Also, we have funnymummies.com, which has upcoming gigs, shows, fun stuff. You can find me, Jenny Winter, which is W-Y-N-T-E-R, why? Because I can. At jennywinter.com, you can find me on Facebook at Jenny Winter Comedian, Instagram at Jen Winter, and your child could be the voice on this podcast. So if your child would like to say, with Jenny Winter, record that as a voice memo, send it through to me. You can either send it via the Facebook group or via my website, and they could be the voice on the next episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope that you find some funny in your day.
It's the Funny Mummies with Jenny Winter.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.